Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and we're covering a lot of content. I can't believe that we're almost out of year time, or I should say more time for this year, because as January comes, we have the Tory acts to dive into and start all over again. So there's a lot of stuff that we need to cover, and last year I probably spent two whole months going through the Constitution, almost up to Thanksgiving, and this is kind of why I want to gloss over it, but it seems like yesterday I was really not glossing over too much, and there's a reason why. But before I get into that reason, it is now or never. That debt is fraud, and let's try to invoke the power of heaven in restoring and reclaiming our republic, because any other option of, you know, armed revolution, constitutional convention, just nullifying or just going our own separate ways of succession or trying to use the court and continuing to do the status quo, that none of those ways is going to do it. It requires action. It requires action by we the people. We the people have to petition. We have to drive and demand. The reason our government is behaving so badly is because we've let go of the reins. I mean, we've literally got a, you know, a stagecoach out of control. Yeah. And so anyway, welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And so yesterday I spent probably, you know, almost the whole show covering that one amendment and the apportionment. The reason why this is so important is because the center, again, as I asked you yesterday, what form of government do we have? A Republican form of government, right? And so representation and understanding the relationship. So who are the bosses of our public servants?
We are.
And so understanding that is really important, because today we're not. Who are the bosses of our representation today? In other words, if you're going to get elected, you want to become a public servant, you want to throw your hat into the ring, who do you really need to have, you know, kind of step up and go, yeah, we want you to, you know, do this and we want you to do that? Who is it that actually has the say on whether you get elected or not?
I don't know. The people with money?
Okay.
Running to their campaign? I don't know.
Okay. The party. And I say that because when it comes down to the general election, the people that have gravitated towards a party will vote blindly for the party. They don't even care anymore. They don't know. We've removed ourselves from our own representation, and we basically have assigned ourselves representation of whatever it means that the party says.
Right.
So what form of government would that be? Would that be a Republican form of government where the sovereigns are actually being represented? Or did we create a new sovereign?
It's the parties who are being represented.
Right. So in other words, by allowing the parties to have control, we've allowed them to become a sovereign in ruling us. And so they have a role within this out-of-control government in making sure that there's no accountability to those people. Because if the party really cared about what those people were doing and how they were voting, if they really cared about the issues, they would hold them accountable. Like rhinos, look at John McCain. Look how long John McCain violated the platform of the Republican Party. Look how long John McCain got away with the shit. And his entire career, he was never held accountable. There was a point in time where the party, the people of Arizona, got so fed up, they censured him, and he still got elected.
Wow. Yeah.
Because even though the party didn't remove him, what they should have done was they should have said, you can no longer be a Republican. They should have actually removed him and actually had the party really invoked what they should have been doing in compliance of the Constitution and really protecting the Constitution, then they would have actually removed his ability to be a public servant the day he got out of line. As you understand, the essence of these constitutional compliance committees, that the parties need to start invoking this, and that we need to start helping educate the people that we can no longer tolerate a public servant who is willing to be in office and violate their oath of office and not support the Constitution. That is the essence of our problem. There has to be accountability. And the only people that really have that ability to invoke that power is we, the people. In other words, we have to take back the party to take, you know, to take control of our government again. That's one of the facets that we have to do. And the whole point and the reason why this one amendment was that important was when you look at it, it would have kept more control by the people over their representatives. In other words, if you look at, let's say you lived in New York or you lived in L.A. and you've got a few million people and you had representation at that point in time, you know, it was just 30,000. But today it's like three quarters of a million. I think it's probably closer to 8 million or 800,000. I mean, closer to 800,000 than it is 700,000. So that means that there's 800,000 people to one representative. Now you're looking at a city that has millions of people. I think Los Angeles has something like 13 million people that live in that basin. And so now we actually look at how many representatives that you have just with 13 million based on an 800,000 denomination. But let's go back to 30,000. How relevant are both parties now in the county of Los Angeles? Because now you know you've got these little communities easily of 30,000 people that are bleeding liberals. And then you got a few communities over here that are hardcore conservatives. In other words, every little community, because when you're thinking 30,000, that is a community. I mean, how many people live in Cheyenne?
I don't know, 50?
50. Okay, so Cheyenne, if it's possible to actually, you know, create gerrymandering to ensure that both of those parts of that county, if we had 30,000 in representation, that means that they would have basically two representatives, congressional districts representing Cheyenne. And that means that there could have actually be, you know, a single bastion for the Democrats where they would have a majority in one congressional district. And in other words, acknowledging these communities and protecting them. Because if somebody started creating the congressional boundaries of Cheyenne to where it would ensure that the Republicans controlled it, then that would be considered what? Gerrymandering, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the whole point is the protection of our representation. And if we're going to have a representative form of government, that means that the party can't control it. So when we actually do this, it actually makes more real, or it brings forth the concept of actually protecting and preserving the people over the party. But we have surrendered to the party so blindly in the 1800s, that this is why 70 to 80% of the people who cast their vote blindly vote whoever's Republican. This is why many people may not even participate in the primary. Because they just, oh, what really matters is the general, and it's always going to be a Republican. What's the difference between one Republican and another? This is where the whole primary came into be, so that the party itself could help and control the outcome of who's going to represent the party in the general election. Not the people, the party. Because remember, right, a lot of people may not vote in the primary. And only those who are real party people care. And so when the party all of a sudden starts endorsing, the local party starts really getting behind and saying, well, as a party, it's because you're a chair, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so as a person, as an individual, you say, I endorse this person, but as the chair, we support all the Republicans. But if you actually came out and said, I'm voting for this particular person, then that you'd be castigated, right? Because you're actually the chair. You can't do that.
Well, I don't do it in...
I understand, but that's the whole point. That's the whole point of what I'm trying to cover here, is that the party can and actually does and persuades people, because sometimes they will actually endorse one party person over another. And we've seen this, like in Missouri, where we had good, strong, real conservatives. The party would put up and get behind. They would secretly get behind if they couldn't publicly get behind. But if they can, if they actually have allowed themselves the ability to endorse one Republican over another, because they do that. There's plenty of places where the bylaws allow them to do that. They have full control in those areas to make sure that who gets into office will be able to do what they want them to do. And 9 times out of 10, the way the parties are designed, it's not really what they want them to do. They want them to be free to be corrupt and compromised. This is why the party has no accountability. Once you get in there, okay, well, that's good. We own that seat. That's a Republican seat. That's all that they care about. And this is one of the reasons why we never see individual. Now, in Wyoming, we see it a lot. But in lots of places, you never see the accounting of every bill that these people face in the state legislature. Or at the county level, we never see all the things that they did come out to say, based on all of this, this guy doesn't deserve to be, or this gal doesn't deserve to be our representative anymore at the county. They don't do that at all. Now, you understand the petitions, and the whole point of this is actually taking it back to the voters and actually helping the people understand the plethora of things that these people are not willing to do. This is how powerful the petitions and this movement really is, because this becomes the public relations campaign of how these public servants are so crappy, they don't deserve to be in office. That's the power of the petition. That's the power of what this movement is, and accountability. And it goes back to who is really gaining out of this configuration of a party form of government. It's not the party, really. The party is a shill for the globalists, because when we look at who really controls the party, it's really those people with the money. And when you look at, in most all states, Wyoming is a very unique state, but when you look at almost all states, money talks. And money in the party talks louder. And so those people that come in, and you go, why is it that we keep on electing John McCain? Because the money that is controlling that party wants to make sure that John McCain is still in office.
Right.
Even though all of the people just kind of, most of the people in the party, like I said, in Arizona's case, the people of the party wanted to hold him accountable and say, we're going to censure you. But the people, the voters that blindly vote for the Republicans still voted for him, because they already did their the party already did their job by eliminating him by, the party in its censorship. But the Republicans in the primary still supported him over everybody else, because the money in the party spent the money that way. That's where all of the backing went. Anyway, money has a very bad influence over our government, but the party is the one that steers that money. So as we look at the Bill of Rights and we get past this First Amendment, the Second Amendment actually became ratified in 1992, and we know this amendment as the 27th Amendment. And this amendment is basically, this is the Second Amendment. Remember, most people tried to create this logic, and we hear people say, oh, well, the reason this is the First Amendment, because it's most important, and the second and the third and fourth. I mean, it was all put in priority that these, you know, in this order was important to least important, which is why that question still remains and we'll ask after we go through the Bill of Rights, which is the most important amendment. But the Second Amendment, go ahead and read this. It's very short, and it really basically addresses the corruption of representation. So the very first two amendments is really focused on the quality of representation we have. Go ahead, read this one.
The article, the second?
Yes.
Okay. No law varying the compensation for the services of the senators and representatives shall take effect until an election of representatives shall have intervened.
Okay. So at this point in time, the amendment was basically applying a change in the compensation, the salary, what they were to be earning for their services. And so this amendment basically said that if they voted to increase their compensation, that compensation couldn't kick until after the upcoming election. So in other words, if they were in the Senate, and let's look at the Senate. A senator had to wait 6 years, but every 4 years or every 2 years, there's an election. So if the senator that, you know, voted for this compensation change, they couldn't actually obtain their pay until they got reelected. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
In the House of Representatives, every 2 years is a changeover. So when they, you know, every time they're up for re-election, but every three times of elections is when a senator's up for election. So this whole point was really to, you know, to hold back any advancements of pay for a senator for, you know, two cycles. If it became in their very first year they voted for and passed a compensation increase, their very first year, they had to wait their whole 6 years for re-election before they would absolutely feel or visualize or actualize that increase in their pay. So anyway, that's the second. And both of these are really focused on trying to maintain a good representation. Now, everybody knows the First Amendment, but this is actually the third article or the Third Amendment. So go ahead and read the First Amendment.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedoms of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
Okay, so now again, this amendment was basically laid out so that the federal government could not touch these things. In other words, as Madison stated, these were further declaratory clauses so that they couldn't be construed as the federal government having the ability to invoke or be involved in. So the very first thing, Congress could not make any law respecting or favoring the establishment of a religion. In other words, they couldn't say that we kind of like this Anglican church, or they couldn't say we kind of like secular godlessness. Thou shalt teach secular godlessness in the school. Because that would be the establishment of a religion.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's a non-Christian faith. It's actually a non-faith faith.
Yeah.
And so bottom line, they are not supposed to be able to make that law. Now, the 14th Amendment basically lays out that no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen. So if a state made and had a law that actually recognized the Anglican Church as the established church for the state of Wyoming, would that violate that very first clause, Congress shall make, instead of saying Congress, no government shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion? Would that be appropriate for the 14th Amendment? In other words, no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen. Does the establishment of a religion abridge privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen?
Absolutely.
How?
I mean, if they're establishing a religion for the government.
Yes. How? See, technically it doesn't. And this is what really everybody stumbles on this. Technically it doesn't, because what is the purpose of a religious affiliation in the governments in the United States? These churches that were established in every state, they were the ones that took care of the people. In other words, the compassionate services, the welfare, the education, those types of things, that the state did not do that. They did not dare touch education. They did not dare touch welfare. That was left to the people and the churches and the community. The state was not going to get involved. Remember, we covered this in the cod fishery bounties, remember?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember.
And so when a state actually establishes a religion, as long as every person in that state, their privileges and immunities aren't being abridged by the religion, then there's no problem with it. As long as the state doesn't pass a law respecting the next part or prohibiting the exercise, the free exercise thereof. So in other words, if they start passing laws, you have to attend, you have to tithe, you have to, then that actually prohibits. But if they say we want to, and actually the smart thing, and I think the design of the Constitution was to allow the states to not move into a secular, or I should say non-denominational. In other words, we're not going to have anything to do with it. I believe it gave the states the opportunity to create a free market of religious ideas and a free market, because had the states basically said, look, we recognize the power that, having a good, faithful people is. But what we want is we want to have a competition to increase the quality of the faith of people. So therefore, we're going to open, it's going to be a free market where other churches can come in, or other faiths or new faiths can actually rise up to actually, compete against. And if the people choose a more faithful religion, look at what Martin Luther did. Martin Luther broke away from the Catholic Church to try to, get closer to the scriptures. So, that created a new competition when they established the Lutheran faith or the Protestant faith. So when we, look at how the states would have benefited by allowing any type of faith, and then tried to figure out a way so that they didn't have any heavy hands favoring one over the other. In other words, if the state was going to give out, let's just say, they had a pot, and they had, they broke down the people based on population. Now, I believe that, this really gets into a complex, and I'm going to get myself in trouble here because, I have to gloss over this. But I think that there could have easily been a way to basically look at, what the church does for the people and reward them for that. In other words, when the people are contributing, not when a person, let's say George Soros, creates a church in your state, and then the people have their own state, and so everybody is paying a tithe. George Soros is doing this tithe, and he's paying the full lion's share of enabling people to have bad behavior. And this other church has a high percentage of all the people contributing and being a part of the church. Then when you look at the understanding of faith and people uniting and coming together, the church that actually has that high attendance and high participation in sacrifice, that church should be richly rewarded compared to George Soros's church, where he's basically using his money to control these people and getting them to do whatever he wants them to do. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And of allowing churches to compete on that, because, and so we're going into break, so I'll try to dig myself out of this hole when we come back from the break. But I want to be clear. I think that there's really a good way to actually allow this so that you have both a free market and that the people really start gravitating towards the more righteous churches that are really serving the people, not necessarily their carnal desires and so forth. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so there's really not I honestly believe that it would be hard, but it would take time for the states to really create the best possible ingredients or formula of allowing the state to rise to newer and higher levels of enlightenment. You got to remember that enlightenment isn't just knowledge. Enlightenment, a integral part, a foundation of enlightenment is discipline. And so when we look at what a church does and how it, the more discipline the members of the church have, the better or more enlightened and more productive those people become. I mean, if we're constantly being consumed by carnal pleasures and going to ditty parties and such, then, you know, we're not getting things done. We're not getting educated. We're not being productive. We're not improving the quality of the products we're making. We're not innovating. We're just consumed. And that's why America has deteriorated and been debased, because we do not value true education. We do not value these true principles that elevate a society. Does this make sense? And so yes. I think the state legislature should come up with, and I honestly believe that if a state legislature went down the wrong path, out of 50 states, people would start gravitating out of that state if that state legislator really went down a very perverse path, because people would just leave and they'd go, you know what, we're done. And then all of a sudden that state would collapse because the people that would be productive would no longer be there. Just like what we saw happen to California.
I was going to say, just like kind of like California?
Yes, because people vote with their feet. So when we go down this path, you know, I know it is a very sensitive, but it is a very difficult formula to create. But there's no doubt in my mind that if we had good public servants that were truly representing what was best for the people, it would be a state of enlightenment. How can we, you know, get back on the path of enlightenment? We have to, one, start valuing education, true education, the truth. You know, just like in religion, it's about understanding the truth, getting closer to Christ. You know, one of the things that was lacking in the Catholic Church was the concept of, you know, revelation. There was no revelation anymore. It was just, this is what we do. And this is, you know, we just go through the motions and then die. There was no prophets of, you know, the intimate revelation from the prophets to the people. Like in, what is it, Amos, surely the secrets of the Lord will be revealed unto his prophets. Because the prophets were the spokesman for the people. Old Testament and even in the New Testament. All of a sudden with the Catholic Church, that died. That was one of the things that Sir Isaac Newton really highlighted in his book, The Revelations of John John the Revelator and Daniel or something like that. And as a matter of fact, that book is available on my website on constitutional articles. It is a PDF. If you can download these books. But this is the book that actually really changed Jefferson's view on religion. So when we start looking at, you know, having these honest discussions and putting everything at the table, when you have government that says, nope, you know, those ideas can't go on this table. In other words, they start restraining and controlling access. Because back in the old days, it was all about the freedom, and the more free, you know, academia was, the better off it was. Today, academia has, there's no resemblance of freedom. It is a controlled narrative, and everything is a webbing that's interconnecting to support this evil narrative. You can't come in and actually talk about challenging paradigms, challenging, you know, this godlessness to Christianity. Christianity is forbidden in our education system. So my point is that when we start looking at this particular amendment and the Establishment Clause, I believe that the design under the 14th Amendment wasn't to actually keep states, because at the point in time where this amendment was passed, the 14th Amendment, not the First Amendment, the 14th Amendment, that no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen, this had no implication of the establishment, because out of the original 13 states, I believe after the 14th Amendment, there were still three states. I think it was Delaware, New Hampshire, and South Carolina were the three states that still had state-sponsored churches after the 14th Amendment. So the question is, did the federal government go after these states and say, you got to shut down these religions? No, that was not the intent. The intent was to ensure that the people were protected. And they looked at the churches as a separate entity that was to serve the people, not the government. It was providing the compassionate services. So the intent was to make sure that there was a sponsorship or there was something available, because if all of a sudden, when the churches went secular, I should say not the churches, when the states went secular against the churches, they said, we're no longer going to be giving any taxes to churches to help educate, to help you, or anything like that, that really played in the atheists and the godless hands. And what it did was it created this void of, you know, helping people based on their faith. This goes back to this, and let's look at it this way. If all of a sudden you had all of these different faiths and you actually were supporting those that were supported by the people and only those, then Soros would basically be, you know, held to paying all of this money to basically pay for, because these people wouldn't work. These people would be doing drugs. They would basically be doing addictive behavior because they're not trying to become better people. He wants to keep them trapped in this society that we actually have today, where we're all addicted, and don't worry about it. We're taking away the consequences of your problems and sins, and we're going to cover that for you. You get free health care. Just keep taking drugs, and we want to, you know, we want to make those things legal so that you can do those things. I mean, when you really look at the insidiousness of this church that Soros and the federal government was supporting, it was very destructive. And so if the state legislature didn't reward those churches, they only rewarded the churches where the people were supporting it. In other words, by a means of support. In other words, out of all of the people, how many, the higher the attendance and support. In other words, if the more and more people, a higher percentage of the people were presenting more money or tithing more money in supporting that church, then you wanted to reward that church more. Does that make sense? Because the people are really bought into what this faith is providing. You know, when you look at, you know, as a matter of fact, I go to Malachi. Malachi, in the very end of the Old Testament, he basically says, he talks about how that, you know, the people have been robbing God. And how have we robbed thee in thy stores? Because we haven't been giving a free or a generous tithe and offering. He said, prove me now this day that though, you know, if this nation would actually, you know, give an honest tithe and offering, that he wouldn't open the windows of heaven and bless us. And so that right there speaks to the importance of the people being contributors to the church. In the like manner, because I keep on saying there is a mirror to here. When you look at the Constitution has that same model that we, the people, have to be involved. We have to contribute, not financially, but we have to be involved in holding our public servants accountable. And in churches, you have to hold, I mean, when you have these, you know, these pastors that are adulterers and all these other things, and they're going contrary to what they're teaching, you got to hold them accountable.
Yeah.
And so if you don't see the mirror and the importance of this, and in some ways we've done a really good job at the churches, but that's based on faith, right? In other words, you preach that you can't do these things. When we look at the federal government and when we look at our public service, it's not that they can't do these things. They're supposed to do these things and only these things. And when they're functioning in government, we need to, because I'm an advocate of removing this moral filter. You know, even if somebody may have problems, regardless if they're drinking or what have you, we need to give them help. And maybe they shouldn't be in office if they got those deeper problems, because nobody's perfect. As a matter of fact, I remember my father always said, if church required you to be perfect, nobody could attend.
Yep.
And if public service required you to be perfect, nobody could serve. So we have to have a level of tolerance, and we have to come out and say, hey, now that we know you're kind of a philanderer and you're out there doing things that you may not be married, but you're living a lifestyle that we don't like, you can be impeached for that, but you can't be removed from office with Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment holds you to your oath and oath only. So this is where we start really focusing on why is that so important? Because they can only do these things. When they start doing things they can't do, it's just like committing sin.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just trying to create this parallel. I may not be doing a good job. But when we look at how we hold church leaders accountable, it's kind of the same, but it's not about necessarily sin and righteousness. It's about doing things that they don't have the authority to do, or failing to support those things that they're supposed to support, like the invasion and repelling the invasion.
Yeah.
So when we kind of look at it that way, and in an enlightened society, getting back to this enlightenment, holding people accountable is critical. So this is why, you know, we need to have this symbiotic relationship with, I think, religion, specifically Christianity. Why Christianity over all other religions? Because Christianity is centered on liberty. It basically, because what Christ taught was we're all to choose for ourselves what we're to do. You know, when the adulterer was, you know, going to be stoned, and all of a sudden, you know, the accusers left and didn't stone the adulterer, he said, "Woman, where are thy accusers?" And obviously they had left. He didn't forgive her. He just said, go and sin no more. Go and live the law. Because mm-hmm. He brought in a new advent. Instead of an eye for an eye, it was about repentance and forgiveness. And that we all need to, you know, be more forgiving. And I tell you what, America is being, I'll just say, there's this level of damnation because we're not forgiving of people. If we're so divided, the reason why he blessed the original 13 states is because they were united and they got along. They were compassionate, even though they hated slavery in the North. They still considered themselves brothers and akin. You know, so just think about it. Let's look at, a slave state is like an adulterer, or let's look at it opposite. Instead of trying to cast, you know, this hard fixed, let's look at those people who hated slavery as the adulterers, and those who, you know, were doing slavery work. It doesn't matter how you were judging. The judging goes both ways, and we have to put aside those differences to say, for the interest of the union and for the interest of us to get to a higher level, we have to, you know, allow people to choose for themselves. When we start dictating that you have to live a certain way, then all of a sudden you have quickly crossed that line of a person that supports liberty and now supports subjugation.
Mm-hmm.
And so this goes to this fundamental, and I didn't teach this very well in my first book, but I had the scale of liberty. And the scale of liberty on one end where you lived a life of pure liberty, this is a life where everybody had to become informed, they had to inform themselves, and they had to make every decision for themselves. They had to make every decision for themselves. They could seek advice and so forth, but ultimately they had to choose. And so every person has to choose, and you have to choose based on whatever information is. As you get, you may be making bad decisions. All of a sudden you realize, oh, smoking is making me cough. I got to quit smoking. So you're going to choose because of empirical data, because of your health changes or whatever. I'm going to stop smoking. Regardless, as we obtain information, either from life experiences, from science, or what have you, we start making better choices. We have to make those choices. When we believe that you should not be able to do those things, and we're going to make it illegal, we're going to arrest you to do those things, then all of a sudden we've kind of started walking across away from liberty and towards subjugation, to where we get to a point where every action you do must be controlled. It is black. That's that end of the scale of liberty is black, where you have no choice anymore. And in between this pure liberty where everybody has to make all their choices to a point where you have no choices is shades of gray that slowly, slowly get darker and darker and darker until finally we've surrendered to the state government or, you know, somebody else has full control over us. That there is the plan of Satan. And mm-hmm. the plan of liberty is the plan of Christ. And this is why I say Christianity is the place where we actually embrace the idea of individual choice. And so this is why Christianity is it is the center of enlightenment as well. When you start looking at, you know, these fundamental principles, you don't get there. You can't get to these different heights and levels without Christianity. So. Anyway, forgive me for preaching. I hate doing that, and so.
I mean, isn't that the whole reason that Christ was chosen to be our Savior? It's because he was the one who said, "Not my will, but thy will."
Yes.
Which was free will.
Right. Well, so precisely. I mean, I think that that was the plan that we were all to choose, but understanding that none of us would be able to do it without blemish. We needed to have somebody come and atone for our sins. And that was his calling. That's what he did. And we're being told today, or I think people really believe, that Satan can atone for your sins. They're following Satan instead of Christ. And he can't atone for your sins. What he actually does is he rewards you in this life for your bad deeds.
Mm-hmm.
And Christians... And
he
those,
takes away free will, actually.
Right. You have to surrender your free will to him. You have to do what he says. But if we choose, and so when we look at this Christian side of it, where, you know, we have to really make the right choices, and when we make the right choices, that gets recorded, and we receive our reward in the next life. Where in Luciferianism, you receive your reward in this life because there is no next life.
Yeah.
So anyway, all right, so back to the First Amendment, because we're talking about religion, so that's why we're diving into this deeply. So no state can't, or no government can make a law respecting the establishment of religion doesn't apply to the states. And as a matter of fact, when you really think about it, if you want to, you could actually peel this back away from the state and allow this to be done at the county. So that the counties can actually have, you know, these small little, you know, I'll just say free markets of religion and keep the state out of it, where that way there's be less heavy-handed tactics in your area that may be really strong in Amish and Mennonites. you know, where that's the quality of life and that standard of life is a little more compatible between, and I don't want to create a civil war between Amish and Mennonites, but you understand my point, right? That, you know, mm-hmm. they probably gravitate and are more like-minded than the Catholics, and, you know, then we got the Protestants and all these other different faiths, evangelicals and so forth. And so people create communities. This goes back to representation. People gravitate towards each other because they want to live in the area where the people think like them. So anyway, so if the state constitution was rewritten by the counties, I honestly believe that the counties should actually say that this state shall not make an establishment of religion. That would be reserved to the counties that they chose to do that, or if they chose not to. But what's more important is that they actually create a symbiotic relationship at the county level, not at the state level, to start recognizing and help promoting these forms of enlightenment. Anyway, moving forward, or promoting the exercise thereof, or prohibiting the exercise of religion, the free exercise of religion. Now, the next one is abridging the freedom of speech. In other words, the freedom of speech. So what the state of Wyoming basically states is the freedom of the press and the freedom of speech, you know, shall not be abridged, but, you know, you can be held liable. In other words, there's this little insertion. Mm-hmm. Have you ever read the Wyoming Constitution on the freedom of the press?
I don't think so.
Okay. So as we kind of look at the Wyoming Constitution, because I'm going to take a quick second and I'm going to dive into that, because I've got them. State Constitution right here and Wyoming Constitution. I pull it up right there. All right. And then I look up press, because all I've got to do is do a search for press. And press, P-R-E-S-S. This is what the Wyoming Constitution says. Every person may freely speak, write, and publish on all subjects, being responsible for the abuse of that right, and in all trials mm-hmm. for libel, both civil and criminal, the truth, when published with good intent and for justifiable ends, shall be sufficient defense, the jury having the right to determine the facts and the law under the direction of the court. Now, see, one of the things that's interesting is the language in this amendment speaks of civil law instead of common law. In other words, the implementations of civil law were already starting to show their face, because when you look at this, both civil and criminal cases, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at that, we look at civil being this idea for somebody being able to sue for financial compensation. In common law, there was no such thing. I mean, you caused harm and, you know, somebody, you know, apologized, somebody blah, blah, but nobody was literally out there saying, you know, we're going to destroy you financially. That really goes back to more of a civil law and Roman law instead of common law. But the other part of this is the jury having the right to determine the facts and the law under the direction of the court. In other words, there's this thing called a trial by jury and a jury trial. Trial by jury is where the people have the ultimate say and cannot be overruled by a judge. So there's a walking of a thin line here between a jury trial and a trial by jury. A trial by jury, again, is the pure form of that the people have the power to nullify state laws, nullify laws, especially if they're bad or oppressive. A trial by jury is where the judge has the ability to dismiss the verdict of a jury, to say, no, I'm not going to allow this to happen, and they invoke an opposite outcome. And so many states today, most all states today, have jury trials instead of trials by jury. And as a matter mm-hmm. of fact, if you ever watch Law and Order, there have been a couple of cases where the judge overstepped their bounds, or they basically stepped in and took away the power of the jury and said, you got it wrong, this is what has to happen. And that right there is invoking these concept of whether we are living under common law or whether we're living under civil law. And so anyway, so let's dive into the next one. And the next part of this amendment is the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition government for the redress of grievances. What does that mean? How important is that? I should say, actually, when we look at this part of this amendment, this exercising of religion, this exercising of speech, and the freedom to hold our public servants accountable. How important is that?
I mean, it's everything, because we're the ones.
Right. So we kind of talked about, and I really focus on representation. And the whole point of representation in a Republican form of government, it is worthless. In other words, it's not a good form of government if you don't have the ability to control your representation. So this right here, the right of petition for the redress of grievances, is literally the reins on government.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that the progressives knew they had to get rid of, or they had to marginalize, was this line right here. Now, they knew that if they would have passed an amendment that would have actually taken this away or stricken this from the Bill of Rights, that would have just tipped their hands. It's just like censorship. Hey, they're burning the Bible, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this would have truly tipped the hands of their intentions and or the direction that they were going. And so when we look at how important this is, what they did was they redefined it. Over time, over the last century, they actually started convincing people the right of protest is in essence your right of petition.
Right.
So now, how many people understand the First Amendment right of the petitioning and redress of grievances? When we look at what do people do when they're not happy, how many people are writing petitions for the redress of grievances? How many?
Zero.
Well, yours truly, but very few, right? I mean, it's very, very few.
Yeah.
What is it that people do? People have been basically indoctrinated that we got to go out and have a rally. We got to go out and have a march.
Mm-hmm.
That right there lends to anarchy. And as a matter of fact,
we got to go to court.
Correct. There's different ways of resistance, but they got us away from actually being very specific and surgically accurate on saying this action right here is unconstitutional. In other words, that cuts right to the bone of what the problem is. They don't want us to do that. They don't want us to be in the knickers of government so that government can be free to create their 15-minute cities and violate the Constitution and the rights of the people.
Yeah.
So this has been a very maniacal plan that the First Amendment has been under attack, and more specifically, the one part of this amendment that they surgically, I'll just say, they desensitized completely. They took away its meaning because they didn't teach this, the right of assembly and to petition government.
Yeah.
Those two parts, I mean, they in ways they basically talked about the assembly and the right of association, but they completely got away from people being able to assemble and hold government accountable. Really, when we look at January 6th, and so we'll have you back next week, Tammy. So when we look at what happened on January 6th, we really look at the atrocities of how they really violated, how the federal government violated the Constitution by not allowing people to, one, assemble and petition them. They were the ones that were actually running an insurgency against the Constitution. This is why we're Reclaiming the Republic. I'm G.R. Mobley. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract. And with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.